Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
In the 1970s, salmon fishing in the Gulf of Alaska was becoming crowded, with many vessels vying for harvests, driving down prices, and making it harder for Alaskan fishermen to make a living. And many of those rural fishermen had been fishing for generations. The state's answer? A new regulatory system called limited entry, which winnowed down how many boats could fish through issuing a limited number of permits. After 5 decades of the limited entry program, many rural communities have lost the majority of their local commercial fishing permits. How did this happen, and what does it mean for the future of rural Alaska's economy? We'll discuss 50 years of limited entry fishing in Alaska today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
From Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The idea of limited entry seems like it would be sound. Limit how many vessels can harvest from the ocean to protect fishery stocks, ensure fishermen can make a living, and protect the thousands of years of traditions for native coastal communities to catch fish to barter, sell, and eat. But decades after the system was enacted, rural fishing families hold dramatically fewer permits than they once did. So what went wrong, and is there a way to reset how permits are allocated to commercial fishermen? How much has the loss of village-based commercial permits affected the local economies of those communities? Here to help us understand the system and why there are calls to change it is Glenn Haight. Glenn is a commissioner and current chair of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. He joins us from our friends at KTOO studio in Juneau. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, good morning, Lori. Thanks so much for having me join today. Appreciate being here.
I appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us. And Freddie Christensen is in the studio with us today. Freddie is a commercial fisherman from Old Harbor. Hi, Freddie.
Hello.
Thanks
good morning.
So much for being here.
Thank you.
And also in the studio is Nat Herz. Good to have you here, Nat. Nat wrote a story in February in his in the Northern Journal, which Nat is the editor, publisher, reporter.
He's a janitor.
Kind of a one-man band. The story in February was called The Last Skipper in Yuzinki, How Gulf of Alaska Villages Lost Their Native Fishing Fleets. Welcome, all of you. Thanks so much for being with us. This is an important discussion. So, Nat, get us started here. What got you interested in this story, and what communities did you visit to tell it?
Yeah, thanks, Lori. It's fun to be back here in the studio with you guys, and
it's great to have you.
We got some smelly smoked salmon in the studio here.
I know, it's lovely, lovely display of smoked salmon.
We'll see if any of it gets eaten on the show. So yeah, I was kind of hunting around for reporting subjects a couple years ago, and someone kind of made a point to me, just sort of as a, we were just having kind of a back and forth, and she made the point that it's like easy to get into fishing if your parents have permits or quota and can pass it down to you, and it's actually not very easy to get fishing if to get into fishing if you don't have parents to pass along quota or permit to you. And you know, kind of thinking about that in particular, there's quite a bit of scholarship on the loss of access to commercial fishing as a career in rural indigenous fishing communities in Alaska, and thinking about that kind of in the context of like some of the broader public discourse we've had like in America about like the loss of access to resources like kind of all across the country in native communities, it seemed like sort of potentially an interesting area to dig into. So, you know, there's a big body of scholarship that I read. There are some really distinguished like researchers in this area, like Steve Langdon from University of Alaska Anchorage, a couple other scholars that I've been working with, Rachel Donkersloot, who is out in Aniak, and Courtney Crothers, who lives here in Anchorage. And you know, basically sort of reading up on the scholarship and understanding sort of the extent of the loss in some of these communities across the Gulf of Alaska. And then over the last summer and fall, I traveled to Old Harbor on Kodiak Island with Freddie and another Kodiak community, Yuzinki, and then also was in Bristol Bay in the fall, where kind of there are similarities in the experiences of communities there, but also, you know, some differences regionally, kind of depending on the ways that, like, the fishing fleets and industries, like, kind of have evolved. But, you know, there are the similarities are that if you are a young person, particularly, like, in a rural native village, it's really hard to buy in. Like, in Bristol Bay, like, permits up until a couple of years ago were going for $250,000, and obviously there are a lot of things going on in the fishing industry, like kind of chaos in markets and with processors, and it's, you know, the limited entry system is not the only thing that is affecting people's ability to get into the industry, but it certainly is one thing that, like, we as a state collectively, this was a decision that we made about how we're going to manage our fisheries, and it's certainly one thing that we can control a lot more than we can control, like, Russians dumping low-priced fish onto global markets or the amount of, like, fish people are eating compared to pork. So it sort of seemed like a interesting area to sort of bring up for Alaskans to be maybe thinking about a little more, particularly Alaskans who, I think, if you are an Alaskan, you live in a fishing community, you understand some or much of this sort of history. But if you live, like, in Anchorage, you might be kind of oblivious to the fact that, you know, some of this change has taken place and some of the obstacles that exist. So,
yeah. Well, thanks for getting us started there. Glenn, I want to turn to you now. Give us a brief overview of why Alaska went to a limited entry program. What was happening in the 60s and 70s that made state leaders think they needed to limit access?
Yeah, you bet. I do wish I had some smoked salmon here, though. I didn't know that.
Oops.
Yeah, sure. You know, but prior to 1972, there was a lot of concern about increased participation and entry into commercial fisheries. There was a couple attempts in the 60s to limit participation, but those failed. So in 72, there was a constitutional amendment that allowed the state to limit participation in commercial fisheries. And so that opened the door for the legislature to create the Limited Entry Act. And so that came on in 73. Now, one of the things about the creation of the Limited Entry Act was it was purposeful in trying to get permits into the hands of people who lived in these small villages, these coastal communities that are really fisheries dependent. I mean, there's not much else there. And the way they did that was through a criteria called economic dependence. So theory being, if you lived in a village that had nothing but commercial fisheries, you could demonstrate that most of your income was from that, and you would score more points. The system also allowed for scoring points based on what they called available alternative occupations. And so that's basically what it sounds like. If you don't have economic opportunity, you could score more points. So it was purposeful in the development of this act to get permits into the hands of folks in these areas.
So limited entry was put in place. Was it only purse seine salmon permits at first? And what other fisheries have these limits?
Oh, no, yeah. There was 19 salmon fisheries listed in the original Limited Entry Act, and all of those were limited in 75. And since then, there's been over 60, including those, 60 fisheries limited, ranging from herring to sablefish, crab, shrimp.
And you talked about the scoring process for rural communities, but what were Alaskans generally given preference over people from other states for permits, or could you not do that?
Yeah, right. You couldn't do that. That wasn't done. Even this, I mentioned this availability of alternative occupations criteria. What they did is they used the census area to make that determination. The courts later asked CFEC to be more surgical in that, but. So if you were in a census area that was economically depressed in Oregon, you might score the same amount of points as if you were in Wade Hampton.
And I would just add here that, in fact, like, before the 1973 Limited Entry Act, the legislature had previously tried to sort of create regimes that were more, like, exclusive of non-residents, but the courts struck those down under the Equal Protection Clause.
Yep. Yeah, CFEC is famously not successful at disadvantaging non-residents.
All right. Thank you. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the legacy of limited entry fisheries. In the studio with me today is Freddie Christensen. Freddie is a tribal commercial fisherman from Old Harbor. Nat Herz is also with us. Nat is a journalist, publisher of Northern Journal, and in February published a story called The Last Skipper in Yuzinki, How Gulf of Alaska Villages Lost Their Native Fishing Fleets. Freddie, thanks for being patient here. I want to get you in this discussion now. You said that state officials came to your community to have people sign a petition in the 70s related to limited entry. You were very young then, but what can you tell us about that time? What did people know about what they were being asked to sign?
Well, back then, you know, I can't remember what year they were there, but it was early 70s. But there was a notice put out by my brother-in-law, mayor at the time, that they were going to be having the state people come down, or some people coming down to sign a petition to support and protect the native people's fishing. And it's basically the way it was portrayed. And so that was my understanding of it. And so a lot of people signed that petition in the village because they thought that was going to be protecting their future, generations to come. And lo and behold, some of them that signed it had retired in 67, or 66, and so they did not qualify for their permit. And so even though they signed a petition, they'd retired in 66, and the qualifying years, I believe, was 67 to 71, or something into that effect. Anyways, there was a few of the people, and that didn't come to light until I got older, that, you know, and then I'd heard that they were fighting for their fishing permit and what have you. But you know, that to me, you know, sort of struck me because we were up as I got a little older. There was a lot of things happening. ANCSCA was happening. I mean, it was just a whole bunch of things that were happening to our people in our communities. And so I recall that one sticking out foremost than anything else on how I just feel that, you know, we were off to a bad start.
And how was, you said people signed the petition thinking they were protecting the future, but were they all gung-ho about it, or was there some suspicion about what's happening here?
Well, there was a little suspicion, but they were also believed in our leaders of the community. And if the leaders of the community at that time believed in it, then, you know, you sort of went along with it because that's what their job was to, you know, give you the ups and downs on everything. And you know, nobody really knew anything about, you know, our potential fishing rights, if you will. Mm-hmm. If there would have been a different structure, it would have been incorporated in ANCSCA or something to that magnitude. It just, you know, and that's one of the number one things in my books about, you know, Plod and ANCSCA was, you know, not addressing our fishing rights.
Thank you. Glenn, I want to go back to you now. You said in the 60s the Alaska legislature was trying to Alaskanize fisheries. Talk a little bit more about what that effort was and how it fared.
I'll do my best, Laura. I'm not a great student of all of it, but there was, I believe, the legislature two times tried to pass some laws that would limit participation, and because of, I think it was Article 8 of the Constitution, Section 15, Subsection 15, it says there can be no exclusive right of fishery. You can't direct fisheries to an individual or group of individuals, and so that's where the constitutional amendment came about. That allowed for it to be done strictly for commercial fisheries.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, so thank you for clarifying that, because when I thought about the way this Constitution reads about the maximum yield for all Alaskans, I wondered how so that took a constitutional amendment.
Correct.
All right. And when the system was put in place, I know you talked a little bit about the scoring. How much money did people have to put up to get into the fishery at that time?
I think the application fee was pretty small, less than $100.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the initial issuance were free. If you could prove the history, and score high enough, you were awarded a permit for no cost. Now, if I could, Lori, this is sort of the element that we should talk about a little bit about. The permits were designed to be freely transferable, meaning like if I owned a permit, I could sell it to you if you wanted to buy it. We could gift permits. They moved around. They moved with the person. And there were some advantages to that. Of course, it had value. A person could enter and exit pretty quickly. It was not administratively heavy. The market sort of took over and created the mechanisms to do all that. And it was theoretically thought to bestow a sense of conservation to the holder. So there's the pros and cons of that. But it did create a system where the permits were going to chase money and the highest bidders were going to win. So if you're coming from a community that doesn't have any other original wealth other than fisheries, you're a bit of a disadvantage. And just over time, as a permit would leave a village, it was really hard to get that back. So that's the out-migration. It's because these things were created as freely transferable.
And I think Nat, I would please. Just jump in there too, like having reviewed like a lot of the data and history, it's like I think one thing that Glenn is getting at that probably could use like a little more emphasis is like certainly there were some issues at the start of limited entry where people who probably quote unquote deserved permits did not qualify for permits, as Freddie was kind of suggesting. But I do also think like you look at the data and a lot of places in rural Alaska, in small villages, like there wasn't a big outcry over people not getting permits. Like a lot of people got permits and just kind of kept fishing the way they had been, and there was like a large proportion of the originally issued permits went to rural native residents. But because of this free transferability provision that Glenn was describing, there were basically sort of very few barriers to these permits subsequently being sold or otherwise leaving the communities, both through sale and through like people who lived in the communities, like moving out of the communities and taking the permits with them. So I think there's sort of two steps to this process. Like one, permits were issued, and then really I think there was a kind of initial like big pulse of permits that left communities in the first 10 or 20 years, but then there's just been this kind of steady trickle, sort of punctuated by periods of like low prices, low fishing numbers, and that's really kind of periodically like sent more permits like out of rural communities and toward, you know, whether it's more urban Alaska or Washington, Oregon, etc.
And Glenn, I know you weren't there when they formed this, but do you know, was there any discussion about a different type of license? I mean, you don't want to restrict somebody's ability to engage in commerce and freely do what they want to do if they want to buy or sell something. But was there any consideration of having like two different types of licenses, maybe a heritage license that went to families who had long connection to this resource that would be transferred from generation, but the idea wasn't to sell it, but to transfer it. And then there could be a different, was there any consideration of separating these things out?
Yeah, good question. Within the freely transferable concept, gifting was part of it. And I think that was more of the inheritance thought. Yeah, they discussed different kinds, for instance, non-transferable permits that would revert back to the state. Once an individual was done with it. And they discussed it quite a bit, beat it up in these committees. I think they just, it was more than they could get to in the period of time that they had to pass the law, and the freely transferable route seemed to be the easiest for them to get to. But they did discuss other types of permits, and we have other types of permits, you know, on the books right now, not so much a subject of this discussion, but they could create a different kind of permit.
Freddie, you said in an earlier interview that limited entry was the beginning of the end. When did you first start thinking of the permit system as a failed idea?
Well, you know, it could take me a while to answer that question, but it goes back to when I was a child, as far back as I could remember. I could remember the 1964 tidal wave earthquake, you know, 20 seconds of it or a minute of it. The next thing I remember, that was in 1964, I was 4 years old. But 1965, I you know, was fairly attentive and remembering a lot of stuff. And obviously when I got 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, it was, you know, the kids that I grew up with that I, you know, have helped me, you know, to advocate for our people, if you will. But it wasn't until probably after it was enacted that, you know, because that time frame, being 5 years old and remembering all of us boys down the beach with our own little seniors that our elders made us, or our family made us, or our brothers made us, whatever, and practicing and becoming a skipper, a fisherman first, and then becoming a skipper, a skip man and a skipper. And so by the time limited entry was enacted, it was obvious that our dreams were crushed for them young boys.
You talk particularly about a group of friends when you were talking to Nat earlier about your group of 9 young men who were friends. What happened to that group? Did others get to be skippers like you?
Nope. I was the only one that was able to buy a permit when I was 17 from my cousin. And the other ones continued to be a crew member, but and very self-destruction going on. And it wasn't until I was a little bit older that I realized, you know, the impact of limited entry on the kids, you know, the guys I grew up with, you know.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of why that system and why, like, the permit became an obstacle for those guys when, you know, maybe that wouldn't have existed before?
Well, I think that people couldn't afford it, you know, couldn't afford the permit. You know, I bought mine for, I think, $28,000. And I had a big salmon season with my brother in 1977, and I used the majority of that money to buy a permit for a down payment. And thank God I had a cousin that was willing to finance the rest of it. But the other ones didn't have the opportunity because they weren't available. And so by the time, you know, they came to realization that they're not going to be an owner of a boat or a skipper of a boat because of the program, that, you know, it was all downhill from there from them. I mean, their, you know, attitudes changed, and I wasn't realizing how much of an impact it was until later, you know, but yeah.
And you, Freddie, you talked about a lot about the importance of self-determination. What did you see in terms of community pride and health after limited entry, and how did it affect the mental health of young people?
Well, obviously, you know, what everybody, you know, was sort of just accepting the fact that it's just the way it was. And so, you know, our community was vibrant. We had a lot of fishermen in our village, I knew 30, 35, 40, whatever the number was. I hear numbers between, you know, 33 and 38, but nonetheless, our community was vibrant.
We you guys had a movie fishermen. Theater.
Yes, we had a movie theater. We had a very, you know, if we would have continued to be able to practice what we were doing then under self-determination, we wouldn't have 30 kids in our school right now when we used to have 130 or 127, you know. So I'm not, you know, I don't want to convey that, you know, or say that this limited entry was one, you know, is the main problem, but it's part of it. You know, there was a number of factors that were put in place to get us to where we are today. And I would hope and think that, you know, there's got to be a way out of it, you know, for our people.
Well, and when you think about limited entry and permits going away, as the community is affected by that, it's also having a ripple effect with other businesses, correct? Stores, lodging, maintenance, jobs, those sorts of things also leaving.
Oh, yeah. But I think the one that sticks out the most is the social portion of our people. The, you know, the health and social part of our people was probably more notable than anything, that, you know, especially the younger generation that were my age. You know, we look to our elders, we look to our older brothers and sisters and elders and everybody else in the community to help us get through what we were, you know, dealing with. And there really wasn't much they could do other than, you know, you better get your permit from your dad or your brother or work something out, you know. But when you got a family of, you know, 7, 8 boys and there's dad has the permit, well, the other ones aren't going to be able to, there's going to be 5 out of, you know, 6 that's not going to get a permit unless you buy one, you know.
So it immediately set up tension within families and was probably
absolutely
divisive in the community.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe just to, like, put a finer point on it, because I think we haven't sort of gotten to that level of specificity, but, you know, I was in Old Harbor with Freddie last summer. And I mean, I think Freddie, you were saying, you look at the data, like there used to be, you know, 30, 35 seiners in the harbor, in Old Harbor. And you guys had maybe four or five this summer. And then I, you know, also spent time in Yuzinki, which, you know, I don't, you know, Yuzinki's a small community. I don't know that they ever had like a huge fishing fleet, but they had boats, plural.
Over 20.
Yeah, Yuzinki. Yeah. And now Yuzinki is that there's one guy. Nikolai Katelnikov, who's still a commercial fisherman there. And, you know, I think sort of we as Alaskans, like it's appropriate to be asking ourselves, like, is that an outcome that you know, we want to accept for our rural communities? And, you know, if it is, it is. And if it's not, then, you know, how do we potentially change this? And, you know, I think I was really interested to hear. I'm sure there were some commercial fishermen in the audience, and I don't know if Glenn maybe sort of puckered a little bit hearing you say, like, if there's a way to reset the system, because there are a lot of people with a lot of money wrapped up and debts and investments wrapped up in this system. But, you know, there are also, I think, you know, maybe we'll probably get to this a little later in the show, but I think there are also some concepts that, you know, probably less than blowing up the whole system, more along the lines of like tweaking it around the margins, if we feel like we want to try to achieve some slightly different goals and ends than the ones that have been achieved over the last 50 years.
Yeah, and I do want us to delve into some possible ideas, and we can do that after the break. But before we take that break, Nat, stay on that theme a bit about what you heard from community members about the loss of opportunity and how it affected young people in villages.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Freddie's like story of that, I think, really was is the best. But I mean, I think I also spent some time with a guy out in Bristol Bay, Jerry Leboff, who he moved there as a young guy from California, learned UPIC and became like a tax preparer, and so had this like kind of really amazing.
He was a volunteer, right?
Yeah, he, yeah, he was like a volunteer in service to America, and also a commercial fisherman. But you know, the kinds of stories that he told about sort of seeing it's like, you know, there, it's all in the data, right? Like you look at the data and it's like there are all these communities that have seen their permit holdings go from 10 or 20 to 30 down to, you know, 0 or 5 or 10. And, you know, it's like each of those communities, like every one of those permits is a story, right? About someone who, yeah, you know, fell behind on a loan payment and had to sell, or just like was ready to retire and couldn't afford to give it to their kids, so had to sell, or was confused about the way that the system worked at the very beginning and sold the permit because they thought they could get another by qualifying for free. And I think, you know, it's a hard issue because, like, ultimately, these permits were at least ostensibly like all sold on the open market in arm's length transactions. And I think, you know, you can kind of reasonably ask, like, OK, if people were paid a quote unquote fair price for these permits, like, why do we need to like go back and sort of right a quote unquote wrong here? And I think, you know, one thing is that if you're a young person in a rural Alaska community, like, you didn't sell your permit, all you know is that you don't have access to this livelihood, and you know, that I think is sort of at the root of the question that folks are asking about this system now. So it's tough stuff.
All right, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the legacy of limited entry fisheries and ideas for what the future could look like as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the legacy of limited entry fisheries for the Gulf of Alaska fishermen and how it's affected rural communities in the last 50 years. In Juneau at the studios of KTOO, Glenn Haight is joining us today for the discussion. Glenn is a commissioner and current chair of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Mm-hmm. In the Anchorage studio with me is Freddie Christensen. Freddie is a commercial fisherman from Old Harbor. And also in the studio is Nat Herz. Nat is a journalist and publisher of Northern Journal. He recently published a story called The Last Skipper in Yuzinki, How Gulf of Alaska Villages Lost Their Native Fishing Fleets. My two guests are enjoying some smoked salmon
now. No, fair.
Smoked
chum. Good.
Smoked chum. Can't beat the smoked chum. It's great we had that long break to really crack into it.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So, okay. So, Nat, I do want to come back to you. As part of your reporting, you spoke to former Sitka state lawmaker Jonathan Christ Tompkins, who tried to stem the loss of permits. Talk about what he tried to do.
Yeah, this is sort of where it gets starts to get, I think, political. Obviously, really, this has been political for the past 50 or 60 years. But I think, you know, it's really easy for us here in the studio to talk about, like, you know, we have a quote unquote, we have a policy and we have to fix the policy. But then you remember that there are thousands of fishermen that have invested tens or, well, not tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, in their permits, in their boats, in their nets. And they're looking at any discussion around how do we change the limited entry system as, like, you're about to potentially tank the value of my huge investment. And so Jonathan Christ Tompkins, Democratic former state legislator from Sitka, he was sort of looking at the problems in rural Alaska that it had come along with limited entry, and proposed sort of, I would say, a marginal change to the system. Right now, permits are, Glenn can correct me if I'm going to be technically wrong here, but I think it's fair to say, generally speaking, permits are only allowed to be owned by individuals. They can't be owned by corporations, nonprofits, correct, tribes. Mm-hmm. And so what Jonathan wanted to do was create what they were calling a fisheries trust, which would be sort of a nonprofit. It could be sort of a tribal entity that would basically be sort of a little bit of a community clearinghouse where they could raise money to buy permits and then kind of farm them out to younger or aspiring or new fishermen who may not be able or be ready to make that multiple $100,000 commitment to, like, buy a permit, buy a boat, but could build up some experience, some, like, track record that they would then potentially be able to use to finance their own permit and sort of use this as sort of a stepping stone. It was a, I think the idea was for it to be tested basically initially just in a, maybe sort of a few places on kind of a pilot basis. And, you know, the legislation never got out of committee. And this is sort of an area where I'm focusing my reporting right now. Like, I published one story, there's going to be another one in a few weeks, sort of looking at, okay, if we agree that the system needs to be changed or that we don't like the outcomes, what do we do about it? And there are some concepts out there, like, mm-hmm, this fisheries trust idea. Glenn, I think, could probably walk us through some of the others. But I think I've been doing some surveys of commercial fishing industry stakeholders. And basically, you kind of float these ideas. And a lot of folks are like, no, we don't think this is going to fix the problem. And it's going to really disrupt, like, the huge investments that we've made and the careers that we've made. And those are, you know, these are all groups and individuals that are very well represented in kind of the halls of Juneau, have access to folks who are the decision makers in these areas. And I sympathize with them. It's like, you're trying to scratch it out, especially right now as a fisherman. Like, it's a brutal industry, and I don't want anyone, like, going in there and messing with my permit and with my but you know, at the same time, like, how I think we need to ask ourselves, like, how much are these sort of incremental changes really going to affect people who are part of the industry already? And I don't know, that's definitely subject of debate.
And so, Glenn, jump in there. What are you hearing about the potential for changes? It sounds like there wasn't much appetite for it when Jonathan Christ Tompkins was trying to gain ground and get some traction with some legislation. But are there ideas out there now that you think could get support?
Yeah, well, Nat did a really good job describing sort of the intrepidation that the commercial fishing industry has. You know, through this most recent legislative seafood industry task force, there is some potential that the House Fisheries Committee may seek to have an interim work group that would work over the summer and into the fall, winter, taking a look at Limit Entry Act and seeing what the possibilities are. Because the concern that people have is that if you made some tweaks to the act, you really could upset the apple cart. It is, litigation has loomed large throughout the history of this act, and so people are concerned that something could be done to flip the switch. But I do believe that it is certainly worth looking at and exploring it and having some strong legal opinions about it. I think there's reasons to to be concerned about losing this economic activity in rural Alaska? I mean, I think it's probably one of the top natural resource challenges we have in the state. I think it deserves some review. There are some concepts out there. Representative Christ Tompkins had the what essentially is a permit bank, a regional permit bank, and that's not a novel concept. There's some out there in the country. Maine has one, for instance. Other ideas to try to develop a non-transferable permit that would be regionally based, and that has a lot of legal challenges. That it may not prove to be legal. I mean, that's part of the concern here. But that's a concept. And what you have, though, is you have a set number of permits in each fishery. Probably don't want to increase the number of permits, but in almost every fishery, there's what we call latent permits, permits that aren't fished. Hmm. And then if you dive in deeper into the permits that are fished, most of the value in the fisheries is earned by a fewer number of people. So those are your highliners, those are your really aggressive fishermen. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that are going to be more vocal and be really concerned about it. There's probably a proportion that wouldn't mind getting bought out, right? And we have provisions, they're clunky and they don't quite work for this, but we have provisions that would allow for a buyback. And so it's possible that you might be able to buy out the latent permits and some of the, they're not non-performing permits, but the lesser performing permits, and convert those into a regionally based non-transferable permit. And in doing that, you possibly increase the value of those highliners, of those existing operators, because there'd be fewer transferable permits that might increase the value of the permits, that might actually increase their access to resource. So there's things to look at.
I see Freddie listening closely to what you're talking about here, Glenn. And Freddie, I wanted to ask you about something I think you had mentioned that people had talked about trying to have some sort of a economic zone around like a 10-mile zone of fishery, sort of an exclusive zone for people in that region. Mm-hmm. Was that idea put forward or was it just discussed?
No, I think it was just discussed.
Okay.
Yeah, an idea to try to help protect a resource and a people, exclusive to the village. And obviously there's some challenges with that, but it was an idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's putting everything on the table as an idea. And I think that when we go back to the state limited entry program, Glenn, I find it alarming, especially, being part of the state of Alaska resident, as indigenous people and native people of rural Alaska, I find it alarming that they have not been able to come up with a way to allow ourselves to help ourselves. And when I say that, I say it in the sense of that the state limited entry program, if a young kid from rural Alaska, Old Harbor, wanted to buy a permit, and one of our native entities was willing to come forward to, loan them the money for that, it's not allowed. Mm-hmm. But yet the CFAB and the state of Alaska can keep that as collateral. And because if somebody's going to loan money out, a native entity or native organization, they want to have a guarantee that they could take that as collateral, but they're not allowed to do it. And so I think there's a lot of things that could be brought forward, to allow our native people. We're willing, as self-determined people, we're willing to try to help ourselves, but we need the tools to get there. And currently we don't have them. And in fact, it's not allowed. And so I guess my question is how did CFAB come to be able to, loan money out on permits and keep them have them as collateral?
And before you answer that, Glenn, I wanted to clarify, when you're saying it's not allowed, you mean because of the distinction between an individual owning a license and a corporation, right? So they couldn't loan the money for it because if they took it back in foreclosure, that wouldn't work?
No, some of them, I'm saying not allowed.
Right.
And I'm saying that, we Native organizations shouldn't be looked at any differently than the state of Alaska, loaning, a resident, money to buy a permit, and be able to have that as collateral.
Glenn, your thoughts there?
Yeah. I mean, all the stuff that you're talking about, it's in statute, right? So it's going to be a change that needs to get made by the legislature. And it may be perfectly legal to do what Freddie's talking about. There's provisions. The program was designed to be an owner-operator industry, and one of the things it didn't want having happen was that permits would get leased, be owned by someone, but they never fish, and that they would perpetually, annually lease the permits out. They didn't want that. So there's provisions that say that you can't lien on a permit, and they've very strictly held it to the only groups that can put a lien on a permit is child support, which is different, but there's also Department of Commerce's Division of Investments can put a lien on a permit, as can the Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank, CFAB. And those both are constructs in state government. CFAB was created by the legislature. It's since moved and privatized itself. But that's why they're there. I would think it's possible to do other organizations could do it. The concern that you'll hear people with having other entities, like what Representative Christ Tompkins is talking about, is that if you start to move it to more institutionally held and owned, then what's going to stop a bankruptcy court from saying, well, you're allowing an institution to do it over there. Why can't this creditor or this bank do it? So that's the legal concern that people have with that. But I think it should be definitely discussed and explored and see if there's a route to it.
Well, it certainly you've answered the question that we had by email here when it comes to other entities helping out with buying licenses. Wally writes, I believe positive progress on this issue, which is overdue, would benefit from wider context. I've lived in Petersburg for more than 50 years. The limited entry system has arguably been essential in building the prosperity of our village by providing a degree of stability that has allowed our fleet and support infrastructure to modernize, allowed establishment of businesses to support it. I can't pretend the system hasn't had its local issues, such as concentration of wealth among a few families. But overall, the benefits have been widely felt. I don't think creating new permits for rural villages is desirable, practical, and probably not legal. He writes, it's my understanding some of the apprentice permit program was contemplated when the limited entry system was developed, however, faced legal obstacles. He says, I wonder if village corporations couldn't be involved in financing fishing opportunities for their shareholders to purchase existing permits. Well, we know that can't be part of the fix for this, correct, Freddie?
Yeah. Currently, right now, yeah.
Yeah. And so, Freddie, when you think about if there was a system put in place that some of those permits could again be back in these communities, either new types of permits, some sort of heritage permit, something, What would that mean? What would the difference be in the communities in your region?
Well, I guess at the enactment of in the passage of a state limited entry program, I think there could have been some things done during the if the Constitution allowed it, and if it didn't, then we'd have to amend the Constitution. But my bottom line is there should have been some kind of a regional for Kodiak Island rural community residents and tribal native fishermen to where that entity should have been created to protect all of those, you know, village health permits or native health permits, whatever you want to call it. And somehow they were only sold to that entity and then could have been sold back to the community.
Had to stay in that particular area.
Yeah, they'd have to stay in that area. You have to be a resident, you know, just all kinds of things. But there could have been something put in place, you know, but that's hindsight. It's already, you know, a done deal. We're dealing with what we're dealing with right now. And I just know that, you know, the state limited entry program, as well as halibut IFQs and IFQ program, you know, have been, you know, detrimental to the population and to our young fishermen or people in our village. And I can't help but think that, you know, and not think but know that if there would have been something in place to allow protecting our rural tribal residents, you know, our tribal fishermen on Kodiak Island, that if something would have been put in place, we would still have our 30, 40 boats in the harbor, we would still be a thriving village and not to the magnitude. You know, we got two schools on Kodiak Island, villages that are closed, and some of the best fishing grounds on Kodiak Island, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's all part of the domino effect. It goes in, and not to mention all of the substance abuse and alcohol and drugs and all the things that come with it, you know, and a lot of younger generation. And now I see hope with our young people in our communities. There's a lot of young ones now that have an interest back in, you know, being on that ocean, because the ocean isn't just about, to us, it isn't just about making a living and money. It is who we are. You know, we're most comfortable when we're on that ocean, you know, and seeing all the you know, the ocean come back to life in the spring with the beginning of the herring fishery. Mm. You know, it's just not going out and making money. Yeah, we want to make a living. Yes, we want to, you know, do good and what have you and be up here with the rest of them. But, you know, it's just, it's our way of life. We're connected to that ocean. Without that ocean, you know, and if you don't believe me, without that ocean, look and see what we got in our villages. You know, we had a population base of 300 and some people, almost 400. You know, we had school of 120, 130 students, we you know, and now we're down to 200, 220, 250 full-time residents, three or four resident boats, you know, stuff like that. So, yeah, there's definitely a fix, but it's going to take meeting of the minds and everybody willing to give a little and try to make it work. Because I know that, you know, talking with a lot of Alaska residents in the urban settings, you know, they are absolutely clueless of how the Native people have lost their fishing opportunities and rights and what have you. So.
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the limited entry program and what the future might look like as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're going to the email here from Megan and Walter. They write, no one has brought up the formation of community development quotas after limited entry went active to help alleviate the problem. So CDQs, I had that very same question. Mm-hmm. Are there CDQ operations in your region?
No, not in the Gulf of
well,
Alaska.
Well, that answers that, doesn't
yeah.
it?
No, there isn't. There should have been, you know, because it was CDQ program. To my knowledge, was, you know, about the same time that individual fishing quotas were being issued to individuals on the halibut and federal fisheries. So mainly the CDQ, you know, arose from the federal side fisheries.
And I can maybe just add a little bit
yeah,
of
please.
Context there. So this was when, you know, the federal government was in the process of kind of privatizing some of these really lucrative Bering Sea fisheries, like namely
crab.
For pollock and also for crab. And what Congress did at that time was they basically took 10% of the allowable catch off the top and created these newly formed nonprofit organizations representing rural Alaska. These were not tribal or indigenous organizations. They were nonprofits, and they basically were given the ability to own and manage this quota on behalf of the rural communities and rural residents that they represented. There are a lot of sort of different and competing opinions about sort of how well those CDQ groups have served the Bering Sea communities, but I mean certainly they have brought some significant measure of like money into that region and into some of those communities. I mean, to me, I think it's a really interesting question here that, you know, it gets technical very quickly, but like there are, as you read from that previous email from Petersburg, where the person asserted that sort of collective or rural sort of classes or ownership of permits might not be legal. I think like there are a lot of assertions being thrown around here about sort of what kind of interests the state can try to serve by changing the limited entry system to specifically kind of accommodate its rural and indigenous communities that don't have the kind of access to fishing that folks might want. And I think, you know, certainly we know that some of the concepts that were tested back in the 60s, sort of prioritizing residents, there was an apprenticeship program that, you know, I think made it harder for non-residents to get in. The courts did find those not allowable, but there are other concepts like such as some of the ones that we're talking about that have not been tested. And I think, you know, Glenn probably could speak to like the idea that there are, it's not that these interests that the courts use to reject previous sort of resident preferential treatment, like it's not that those exist in a vacuum. Like if there are compelling state interests that are being served, even if there might be some infringement on this equal protection clause, you might still be able to
make
pass muster with the courts.
Well, and I do want Glenn to jump in here, but first I want to read this email from Janice, who says, or Joe, sorry, says the simple solution is to amend the law to allow communities to purchase permits and be allowed to lease them out to community members. Then funding could be accessed to aid rural communities in purchasing some initial permits. So it seems like we've heard from a few folks that have weighed in here saying that there should be an effort for communities to help their local fishermen. Glenn, do you think something like that could gain traction?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I did help oversee the CDQ program in the 90s, and that was specific to the Bering Sea. And there wasn't a whole lot of Alaska interest in the Bering Sea at the time, so it was easy to take from Seattle, right? And that's what the council did. In 92, they started grabbing pollock quota. And so it just continued from there. And they tried to do something like that in the Gulf with the Community Quota Entity Program. It hasn't quite panned out. But the Gulf has been a hard one to rationalize because there are a lot of Alaska interests there. I'd have to defer to a legal expert about creating a community organization. I mean, that to own permits, that is somewhat of what Representative Christ Tompkins' legislation was trying to do. But it would need to run through the tests.
And talk a little bit more. We only have a few minutes left here, but the CQE, I was not familiar with that at all. I've heard of CDQs, yeah, community development quotas. I've heard of IFQs, individual fishing quotas. But I had not heard of this other term.
It's kind of related to the IFQ program. It's for sablefish and halibut only. It was written into the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And it allows a community to buy and then lease quota out to its residents. It just hasn't taken off because for one reason, there wasn't a lot of resources for communities to buy those. There's, I think, only one community has done it, I think, Kodiak. And I suspect Freddie could tell you more about that. But it is in law, and it has not worked out as intended.
Well,
yeah,
I
please,
would like
Freddie
to respond,
yeah,
to that.
Yeah.
Old Harbor was leading that charge about the CQE, enactment of the CQE program through the council process. And we knew, you know, because we were being considerate, respectful towards a rationalized fishery. Ultimately, you know, we didn't want to go disenfranchise somebody that had bought into the fishery or, have an impact on their fisheries. So we the CQE program, we thought, would be a way for us to get in back into the fishery and allow our people and our rural residents through our CQE to be able to get back into the fisheries and by buying them. Well, we knew that there was a two prong to that, or maybe there was a three, but I knew that we had to get it past the council, or we knew, the Gulf of Alaska Coastal Community Coalition members, board members. And so we were able to succeed with that. The other part of it, though, was a funding mechanism. And we were able to get back to D.C. and do a lot of lobbying and try to get some funding, you know, 50-year loan, 2%, you know, 2% payback, 50-year loan. We weren't asking for anything for free. And had that gone forward, that IFCQE program would have been huge in the Gulf of Alaska. Because we weren't asking for $5 million. It was 180 some million that we were asking for at that time. And maybe at that time it was too much. But, you know, that's how much we figured that would allow all the CQEs to be, you know, successful. And then having that amount of money for the program, it would have been a huge success. And we're still looking for the funding. And right now, you know, there's I can't remember how many CQEs exist in the state of Alaska, but I know Old Harbor and Yuzinki are the two main players on Kodiak Island that are trying to make it work through our tribal government, through our ANCs or whatever it's going to be to try to help and assist. And right now they're not sitting on a whole bunch of quota, but it's enough to, you know, have a couple of fishermen be able to fish it.
Sure, yeah.
So it could have been a successful program, in my opinion.
And we're out of time, but Nat, have you talked to any lawmakers that are looking at this issue?
I'm working on it. I mean, I think my feeling listening to this conversation is like, I hope the listeners are confused because I'm confused. It's like there's so much jargon and acronyms thrown around. Like, this is an issue that took a long time to get here. It's going to take a lot of work and learning by folks in the know to, you know, change it.
Well, I hope folks are not confused because we're trying to provide clarity here today. So
yeah,
thank you. Thank you so much to our guest, Glenn Haight, Commissioner and current chair of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, joining us from lovely studios of KTOO in Juneau. Thanks, Glenn. And thanks to Freddie Christensen, tribal commercial fisherman from Old Harbor, and Nat Herz, journalist and publisher of the Northern Journal. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Wesley Early helped us out today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.